Foodie Films is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things Cage Club related, head on over to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me. Foodie fans, and welcome back to another episode of Foodie Films. Of course, this is your host, your chef de cinema cuisine, Kyle Reinfried. What's going on? What's happening? How are you? Oh boy, Kyle's got a couple of bourbons in him. He's got a delicious burger in him. That's kind of appropriate for this episode because I get to speak with America's burger expert. But he's not only that. He's a filmmaker, he's an author, he's a TV host, the guy teaches lectures, and he's also one of the co-founders, and he's the director of the Food Film Festival. He's making a Broadway musical, but why am I saying all of this? You're going to find it out. This guy is George Motz, not Motz. You're going to hear me say that incorrectly on the episode. Yes, of course, I make a fool of myself, but nonetheless, it is a fantastic episode. We recorded this a while ago. I'm going to be very frank with you. Kyle's going to be frank for a second. I had some audio difficulties. I've been trying to fix it, but it's way past my knowledge of it all. I hope it's not too much of a distraction. Forgive me. George's mic had a lot of poofs and pops and tss to it. So of course I'm pointing out just, you know, things that you might have not even really cared about or paid attention to, but, it's something that, you know, I try my best with this podcast and hopefully you still enjoy it. I mean, you should. George was fantastic. What a cool guy. After we recorded this episode, he took me to the burger spot that he mentions at the end of it, and he's the best, and I hope I get to work with him a little bit more in the future, and, without further ado, you gotta check out, in Jersey City, White Star Bar. There's two of them, but the one that's, I don't know what street that's on. Hit me up, I'll let you know what street it's on. It's the one that's more in the downtown, area, like historic downtown area. They got Pat LaFrieda burgers, and I'll post the picture. Got a bacon, cheddar, cheeseburger, lettuce, tomato, onion. Oh, I was thinking about this episode, and I was like, I need a burger. So we recorded this a little while ago. This was an episode. Well, you're going to hear all about it. Without further ado, Mr. George Motz. Not Motz, Motz. George, thank you so much for having me here. It's a pleasure to meet you. This kind of came to be because earlier this week, I mean, look at this, we're making it happen right away.
That's the best way, right?
Right? Yeah, it's like online dating. Like, why keep chatting on that? Let's just meet right away. Let's go on our first date.
let's hope we have a good first date.
Shout out to Mark Mandler, sound guy, great guy, put us in touch great with dude. One another. So, I just got to say, like, you know, like, I followed you on Instagram already, and I had attended the Food Film Festival 2 years ago, so,
oh, right,
I mean, I knew your name, and it was just, you know, like I said, Mark Mandler, I just, you know, we were catching up like you do when you see people that you're freelancing with. He's like, oh, working on anything fun? And I'm like, eh, you know, the shoots I'm on aren't exactly fun, but I'm working on this project, this podcast, Foodie Films. And right away, he's like, oh, you gotta speak to George Motz and, you know.
George Motz.
I'm sorry. Okay. I even wrote it down.
That's okay. But, I'm the only one who gets it wrong. Don't worry.
Yeah, exactly. He's like, so yeah, he says, you gotta speak to George Motz. And I was like, Yeah, like, how do you, and he's like, yeah, let me give you his information. He's like, well, let me message him. I'm like, yeah, you can message him first, see if it's cool.
Thanks, Mark.
You are, first and foremost, a filmmaker.
Right, thank you for saying that, by the way. People think, oh, you're first and foremost a hamburger guy. Like, no, I'm actually first and foremost a filmmaker.
Yeah,
you're
a director of photography, and then, I mean, did you move? Let's talk about that first. I mean, we can get into, obviously, filmmaking of food,
right.
But filmmaking in general, like, did you go in the natural progression of PA to, like, an AC to camera to DP? Like, tell me your filmmaking stuff.
Well, nothing about my career has been normal.
Oh, okay.
Or there's been no normal progression of anything. I mean, there has been a progression. It's been pretty good. I can't complain.
Yeah.
But at the very beginning, I actually worked for a tabletop director.
Okay.
A great guy named Greg Ramsey, who basically through osmosis, by direct osmosis, I learned pretty much everything he was doing. I watched him work. We worked every day. We worked sometimes. There was a period we were working 7 days a week.
Wow.
For roughly 2.5 months over the 5 years I worked for him. I mean, it was intense. And some of the stuff was food. A lot of it was, you know, toothpaste, and some of it was, you know, paint ads and, you know, kitty litter ads. But we were mostly working on food stuff. So I got really into food photography, and I've always had a thing for food photography to begin with.
Yeah.
But with him, I learned how to light food. I never really knew how to do that. I learned how to light food for photography, for motion picture, and it made a big difference in what became my food photography career. I left him, and I started right away into the world of features.
Okay.
So I was shooting people, but the problem is I was lighting people like food.
What's the difference?
Well, this is you spend a little more time with people.
Okay.
I think, no, it's not true. I think, you know. People move, you know.
Sure, yeah. That's
food just stays right there. You don't have to do anything to it.
Yeah.
But I think the people were just very different. I just didn't know how to light people. I was actually lighting people like they were food, and it was not right. A lot of hard, you know, harsh angles and hard shadows,
yeah.
Which with people we need soft lighting, you know, a lot. I actually got away from that. That was a style back in the day. That was the high contrast back in the 90s, you know. But it's all changed now. Everything started to become very real. And I was moving into the world of Instagram, and I was one of the very first early adopters of Instagram. But back when it was not a food platform, but it was actually a photographer's platform.
Yeah.
People were like, you could change filters and change your camera lenses. Remember that? If you remember the very, very beginning of Instagram.
Yeah, before Facebook took it over and all that.
Exactly. It was an app designed for photographers,
yeah,
who wanted to, like, to snap photos on a cell phone and make it look better than what the actual cell phone camera could produce. So I was one of the earliest adopters of Instagram as a photographer. But at the same time, I had produced a film called earlier than that, Hamburger America. And Hamburger America was about 8 different hamburger restaurants in America. And what I did was I would actually go around the country when I was shooting jobs. I was doing other jobs for other people as a freelance director of photography. And I would tack on a few days in, say, you know, Chicago, and say, I'm going to go up to Wisconsin and go film some hamburger places. And
yeah,
I ended up creating this hamburger film called Hamburger America. And that sort of became the first moment for food on film for me.
That's awesome.
And because of that, the Food Film Fest was born. I was getting as a guy going around to film festivals,
mm-hmm,
and trying to put my film in festivals. I was always getting lumped into the food section of that festival.
Okay.
And I would meet all these other food filmmakers, which didn't really exist. We were a very, very small group back then.
Yeah.
And I was just, by virtue of the fact that I had a film about hamburgers, I was suddenly there. I was that guy. And I took all those filmmakers that I met on the road, and we created our own festival called the Food Film Festival for the first time. And
yeah, it's going
somebody,
into
yeah, somebody walked up to me and they said, "You're never going to be able to sustain this. There's not enough food filmmaking out there for next year." And I was like, "Ha ha, yeah." And meanwhile, I'm like very nervous about it. And sure enough, when everyone had the word got out that there was a place to put your food film, if you had a food film,
yeah,
then we had more than enough films. We had doubled our capacity by the following year.
Wow!
And now we're 13 years in, and we're a well-known entity, a festival. We've been in 5 different countries. We counted last year. We've 105 events over 13 years.
Wow.
Food events.
Yeah,
separate,
yeah.
And,
yeah.
Which that's probably 27 different festivals because it's a multi-day festival. But now there's plenty of content. We'll see. This year we'll probably see 400 different films, food films this year.
That's amazing. Sure. Yeah.
So that's sort of how the food film thing started for me, for sure. I mean, Instagram shooting, and then also my books. I have books about hamburgers now because of Hamburger America, the film.
Yeah, let's say this. So again,
it's a little complicated. Sorry.
Yeah. No, first and foremost, a filmmaker, and then I mean, you've been dubbed the hamburger. Like expert of America, right?
Yeah, it's funny. The media gave me that title, which is funny. Like you
when,
guys.
When was
that? That happened pretty quickly because right when the film came out, I was asked my opinion on burgers, and I started getting called on calls like for CNN and for local news. Mm-hmm. So we need a hamburger expert. Call George. He made a film about hamburgers. So now suddenly I'm an expert. So it started out with one media outlet calling me a hamburger expert, and the next media outlet calling me a self-proclaimed hamburger expert. I said, no, the media, you guys. They called me that, so
yeah.
I accept the title now because the way I like to put it was
not a bad title.
It's not a bad title. America's hamburger expert, sure. Why not? Like America's sweetheart. it's like I'll take that. But I mean, I've eaten more burgers in more places than you have. That's what I'd like to say.
Yeah, that's.
I really have.
I mean, that's a pretty good title. But so yeah, we got filmmaker, we got America's hamburger expert, and now an author of two books. Right?
Two books. One that's been updated.
Updated. Yeah.
So I like to say four books. I've actually rewritten a lot of the books.
Wow.
So yeah, if you get one of my guidebooks, it's been poured over. I've gone over every detail in each one of those books.
Yeah, the Great American Burger Book and Hamburger America.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so that was first you did the film. And then which book came out first?
Hamburger America came first. Someone asked me to roll my research from the film into a book. And I said, well, how many restaurants do you want? There's only 8 in the film. And I said, we'd like 100. I'm like, whoa, 100, holy crap. So I ended up going and getting back on the road again and doing tons of research, Spent my entire advance twice. Lost money on it.
Yeah, I like what you said, that you said to, you want to make sure we keep our hamburger heritage.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you? What did you find? I mean, I want people to buy your books and read your books, but what did you find out about, America, and as far as your love of hamburgers, was it just, you just went out and you had a hamburger when you wanted, or was there always something special?
No, I had an epiphanous moment at the Apple Pan in Los Angeles.
Okay.
Specifically, I was sitting at the counter, and I was in this place I was a little bit jet-lagged because I had just arrived at LAX, and I went right to this place. Somebody told me that you want a burger right now, go to the Apple Pan on the West Side. And I showed up there, I sat at the counter, and I was almost like stoned on jet lag. I was young, I was 25 years old. I was, shooting a job in LA. I was going to work on a job with somebody in LA. And I sat at the counter and I couldn't believe what I was seeing. Like this, it was almost as if I'd been like thrown into this time warp. First time in LA. I'd never been to LA. So I was thrown into this weirdo time warp. If you know the Apple Pan, it's all old school paper caps. Mm-hmm. When you ask for a burger, they scream it out and they slap it on the counter in front of you, and it's very gruff.
Yeah,
it's very fast.
SNL sketch, cheeseburger.
But it's almost like a clean version of that. You know, very very like super like you know clean. There's tartan plaid wallpaper.
Yeah.
There's the red leather stools, and just the turnover is unbelievably lightning fast. And old school pies in the pie window. And I thought I was in a dream.
Yeah.
And I realized at that point that the hamburger could be something way more than just like like the Wendy's McDonald's drive through.
Sure.
I didn't know that though. It was McDonald's and it was my dad's backyard hamburger. There was nothing in between. I'd never really been to or I remembered going to a really good like old school hamburger joint that was focused just on hamburgers. Mm-hmm. So it was an epiphanous moment for me. So I made the film. And they did not make it the film. I love them so much I didn't want to put them in the film.
Okay.
I didn't want to put anything in New York and LA in the film.
Yeah.
The film actually focuses on sort of flyover state burgers, and burgers that were off the beaten path and have great stories.
Yeah.
So, but that turned into the book. That turned into the series of the book, which was a lot of work. It was more work than I could ever dreamed of.
How long did it take to make the film?
It took about 2.5 years over random travel, from jobs. I was doing jobs, nearby, and I would just drive and find stories. But it took a long time. It was non-linear, but it got done. It was a labor of love.
I'm sure you're asked. I mean, I've seen the interviews, just Rachel Ray and Martha Stewart and all that kind of stuff, and people asking you, what's your favorite burger? So I'm not going to ask. Well, maybe I will eventually. But I mean, just as far as making that film, was there a place that just felt like the most special, or just, a location that you're like, wow, this is,
Well, the Apple Pan was one for sure because it was formative. But there's so many places. I mean, people have to realize that there's a lot of different types of burgers in America. That's what I discovered by doing all this research for over the last 20 years is that there's not just one type of hamburger in America. There's also regional specialties all over the place. You get the butter burger of Wisconsin and the green chili cheeseburger of New Mexico and southern parts of southern Colorado and parts of western Texas. The slug burger of Mississippi. You know, these are very specific, historically significant regional styles that I discovered and started to document and take, you know, great appreciation of. You know, to me, it's like that. You know, I believe that the gastronomic fabric of America is very international. It's, a lot of foods come from elsewhere, donuts and everything. I mean, everything comes from somewhere else, with the exception of the hamburger. In a way, the hamburger is one of the only real food inventions in America in the last 100 years or so.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, there's a bunch out there, but to me, it's I think Americans have a lot of pride in the fact that they know it's an American item.
Yeah.
So to that end, when the hamburger started to go out in the world and become the version of the American burger that people saw internationally was McDonald's, unfortunately, or burgers that were fast food and frozen and crap. And I hated the fact that that was going to be, you know, not just the burger itself, but the way that American companies went into foreign countries, I thought was obnoxious. And it was really, I think it was doing a complete disservice to what I consider to be one of the most important foods that America was exporting.
Your film, they made it mandatory to teach or to, you know, to view at Princeton.
For a while, it was at Princeton. Yeah. It was at the, one of the food studies, the hospitality courses at Princeton, at NYU for a while. But I've also now, I've my latest thing is that I've gone international. And I teach courses. I give workshops in Brazil.
Brazil?
Okay. I got a phone call from one person in Brazil who wanted me to come visit, just a fan.
Okay.
And that has now turned into 4 trips later. I'm sponsored by Hellmann's Mayo. Because now Hellmann's is now owned by a brand that's in Hellmann's is an international, it's a multinational brand.
Okay.
But they're really big. They're trying to make big inroads in Brazil right now.
Yeah.
So now I'm being paid by, which is great. I'm on the program for Hellmann's. I love it.
That's amazing.
So they flew me to Brazil last month.
Yeah.
And we ended up making a bunch of content specifically for business to business. I'm actually speaking to burger restaurants as well. Yeah. In Brazil, who want to start and make burger magic.
You're living the dream.
I can't complain. I definitely live in the dream. And I kind of fell into it. It was an accident. You know, you have to, when you're in life, I think you have to accept whatever comes your way and look at everything as an opportunity and not as like, this could be a problem, this could cost money. You know, look at it as an opportunity and see what happens. You know, I did not expect to become a hamburger expert. That was not my goal in life, but it's happened. You know,
I mean, clearly you're a hard worker. No pun intended. You're hungry. Like you do. You know, you love creating content from. Again, let's talk about just filmmaking. You even said to me when I was asking you, oh, what's some of your favorite food scenes? You said you worked on It's Complicated for.
I did. I worked on It's Complicated. I worked on a bunch of films because I was friends with the director.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
Yeah. So semi related to the director at one point. That was an interesting food film because I started thinking about it when you asked me the question about, you know, what great food scenes can you talk about? And I said, you know, there really aren't a lot of good food scenes in films. There really aren't. If you think about it. I mean, this is a documentary.
Yeah.
I mean, I've seen a lot of food filmmaking because of the Food Film Fest. I mean, every year we get, you know, 400 or 500 submissions. We narrow it down to about 28 to 32 selections that we actually screen at the festival. Mm-hmm. So I see a lot of content. But a lot of it is documentary. Or it's, you know, they're narrative films that won't go anywhere outside of, like, the Food Film Fest. They really have no audience. But, I mean, you think of some things like Big Night.
Yeah.
The last scene in Big Night is priceless, where he's making the omelet in all one take. Mm-hmm. I love that one. That's a great one. But, you know, It's Complicated. It was great. Chef was great. But, again, the food shots are, you know, they're not stellar. I like to be able to have, you know, if I'm watching a food film, I want the food to look like I want to attack the screen and eat it.
Yeah.
I've always felt that's my role as a photographer, is to make the food look like you want to eat your freaking phone, you know? Yeah. We did our first season of Burgerland, the TV show. I did a show called Burgerland where I was the host of the show. And after the first episode aired, somebody wrote on the Travel Channel Facebook page, I wanted to eat my effing TV screen. And I'd said to Travel Channel, you know, they wanted to spend an hour at the end of the day shooting food and, you know, 8 hours shooting interviews. I said, no, you got it all wrong.
Yeah, right.
We're going to shoot 5 hours of interviews, and we're going to do 4 hours of food. And they were like, no, that's not necessary. I said, trust me. And we did it. We ended up shooting. The entire afternoon was all tabletop. And it paid off because, you know, B-roll makes up usually half of the content of anything you're watching. And all these shots were literally, it was like the most It was the most graphic food porn you've ever seen. It was I mean, like intense, like low angle shots and dripping cheese and slow motion, beautiful stuff. And people, the feedback was positive. I mean, you have to do that. You know, when you're making food content, you have to make it look pretty. So I worked on this complicated because the director needed someone to shoot some food. And it's obviously about a woman who owns a restaurant. She owns a bakery. I can't remember.
Yeah.
But there's a great scene in the movie where she and Steve Martin, where it's who is it? It's
Meryl Streep.
Meryl Streep and Steve Martin are making croissant. It's almost cut to music. It's made like a music video. I did not shoot that scene, but I was always impressed at how beautiful and how perfect. It was actually, if you watch it, it's actually the way you make croissant.
Yeah.
I mean, so what's really cool about Nancy is that she really wanted to make sure that all the food stuff looked the way it should look. She didn't want to look like half-assed or look like that she wasn't paying attention. Didn't follow the rules. You know, she wanted to make sure everything looked like it should look. So I did a scene where she's icing a cake. So I shot all the insert stuff of her icing a cake.
Oh, okay.
so it looked beautiful. I took from my tabletop, you know, knowledge how to make sure an iced cake looks fantastic. Yeah. So
no, that's the, I mean, we covered that film on an episode, and we played the croissant scene, and I just love it. Just the two of them. I think they're at her daughter, or I don't know, someone, one of the kids' graduation party, and they get stoned.
Yeah.
And then they go, and he's like, "Oh, chocolate croissant."
Well, that's right. They make chocolate croissant. Chocolate croissant. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just such a. So yeah, I love that scene. That's such a great way.
Absolutely.
To capture food. And that's funny. I told before we started recording, I said how I worked, and the listeners know I worked on, you know, Top Chef before, and I worked with the culinary department during we shot the finale, which is like three episodes down in the Bahamas, and since the culinary department's so big and I was just a PA, I was helping them, and that's when I first heard food porn. And you know, they always, the chefs cook the exact amount of dishes for like the judges and then one extra plate for the food porn. I was lucky enough to always be tasting, you know, that plate with them, and
it looked great and probably tasted great too.
Yeah, I remember they just had a portable box that they created just to perfectly bounce the light and get it. Is there any way that you found like certain foods you gotta shoot one way, or like, you know, I mean,
I mean, there's a couple of tricks. I can't tell you all the tricks, but
okay.
One thing I like to point out is that people, it's amazing how many people want to shoot a burger on eye level or like down low or low angle. And for me, especially when it comes to burgers, I like to shoot from what I call the attack angle, which is the attack angle is what you're looking at. So you really want to be able to see the burger from the angle that you're about to attack it.
Yeah.
You know, that's the most important. That, to me, that's the most appealing angle.
Okay.
It's the angle that when they make the burger, they put it on a plate, they're looking at it at that angle also. They're not looking at it down low. They're not looking at overhead.
Yeah.
Overhead burger is nothing but bun. You have to actually – also, a bun – I mean, a burger has – it's going to have a multitude of sides. You keep twisting it around, but it's really only going to be one good angle for some reason. A lot of buns have, you know, have imperfections. You have to find the right angle. But to me, honestly, I use a lot of natural light. I have a great camera phone. I have a Samsung S9 Plus, which has one of the greatest phones ever, and it requires very little light. That's very, very high resolution. And it shoots like no other camera. I mean, I have cameras I struggle with sometimes. This actually has a better camera than some of my own like actual digital cameras. But the great thing about it, it's compact and low light is key. You know, but to me, I think natural lighting. If you look at where you are in a restaurant or a burger joint, just make sure that you're it looks good. You know, it's not harsh light. It's not front lit. Backlighting is usually much better. You know, backlight with a soft bounce in.
Yeah.
I walk around with a pad, you know, a white paper pad, and I'll bounce light back into the front of a burger and I'll backlight it. By grabbing a pad and putting it up against the burger outside of frame, you can actually create a nice bounce back into the burger as long as you have a backlight, you know, the sun or something coming from behind you. Or if you're in a really low lit situation, I'll grab a candle, a table candle.
Wow.
Push the table candle just out of frame, and you have this nice warm glow. A lot of cameras, a lot of cell phone cameras can't capture that, you know? I mean, they can. If you're lucky, if you have a really, really good cell phone camera, you can capture that and actually use the candle light to light your food.
Yeah, I have an iPhone 10, and the portrait mode on that is
very good.
Yeah,
That's actually one of the other better ones, for sure. Yeah. People have to know how to use it, though. It's in the wrong hands. It's like, you know, people go, didn't work, didn't come out great. You have to spend some time playing with it.
Speaking of cell phones, so before I really started talking with a lot of people that work in the industry, such as yourself and Pat LaFrieda, a lot of the food people on, just besides like you know, people that love food, so foodies. I had a lot of food Instagrammers on. What do you think of that whole, I mean, you said obviously getting into Instagram in the beginning, but now there's just so many people posting about food. Do you think there are, is it all pros or are there some cons to that?
Well, I've got too much. If people know me, I have a lot to say on that subject.
Okay.
Unfortunately, but I'll be brief.
Sure.
I'll try.
Yeah.
The most important thing is that, you know, when people look at my feed, they have to understand that everything on my feed, I've eaten.
Okay.
Period.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're seeing a pile of burgers, you know, that I've just cooked up for someone else at an event. Obviously, yeah. I'm not eating that. But if you're looking at food that I've eaten, mostly I post on stories all day long. I post a few things on stories every day, so I stay very current. But everything you see, I've eaten. I think I'm pretty sure a lot of these Instagram posters that are food, have food Instagrams, I mean, they don't eat the stuff. They can't. I mean, you see a pile of food in front of a girl who looks like she's, you know, as thin as a stick.
Yeah.
She ain't eating it. Sorry. There's no freaking way. No way. Oh, she's taking a bite, moving on. Because they're getting paid.
Yeah.
I don't get paid. I mean, I get paid by Hellman's, and I barely promote them. sorry, guys. I try. I mean, I do it in a more grassroots way. People know that I love Hellman's. I think just organically that I love Hellman's. They know that. Because I'm actually being, you know, I do projects with them.
Yeah.
And if I'm working with a client, I'm going to give them some love. But I'm not going to do the reverse, which is where, you know, you suddenly want to promote a restaurant or promote, you know, a type of food. Mm-hmm. And you do it in a way that it's pretty obvious that you're not really appreciating what they're doing. I really appreciate the people that I work with, you know. And so that makes me crazy. The other thing, and this is something that I'm trying to fix, and I can't do it alone. I need everyone's help out there.
Okay. Listen up, people.
So listen up. Restaurants are now inventing food that is for Instagram, not for taste. And they like to say, oh, this will taste great, but honestly, they're making things that really won't even fit in your mouth or wouldn't taste good, but they look great.
Yeah.
And there's been a notion that if you get something that looks great on camera, you get people in the restaurant to eat everything else.
Okay.
That to me is completely disingenuous and disgusting as far as I'm concerned. One of the greatest ones, or the worst ones, the biggest offender, I think, is what I like to call the mac and cheeseburger effect. Because what's happening is, I know the chef who invented the mac and cheeseburger. He himself doesn't even like it anymore. He did invent it as a stunt. It doesn't taste good. You know, people, because the problem is when you look at an image of a mac and cheeseburger, you see mac and cheese, you see burger, and you go, that must be great.
Yeah.
The problem is you've ever eaten hot pasta, with hot cheesy pasta on top of a burger?
Yeah.
Bad combination. It's really bad. There's no room for pasta on a burger unless you're having a ramen burger.
I was just going to say, that's the one time. I watched a video where you went around with a guy and yeah, that ramen burger.
Ramen burger is different. Yeah. It's more toothsome. It actually is. It's a crunchy. Yeah. So it tastes much better. I mean, mac and cheese burgers are soft and wet and weird. And they don't taste right. And it literally was invented to look good on Instagram. That's it. So that
soft,
kind of makes
wet
me crazy.
And weird.
Soft, wet, and weird. It's just there's no way to go through life. No way to go through hamburger life. But it's I have a lot of things to say about that. I wish people would just come clean. And if they're gonna, just people are now starting to say, you know, this I'm sponsored by so and so. You know, if they post something,
yeah,
you know, if they're, it's pretty obvious, they do. But it's very rarely happens. So
yeah, having a food Instagrammers I had on, they gave some tricks of the trade, and some of them, you know, they say, oh, they'll do a potluck night with friends and get takeout, and obviously through then they just have a whole, they're like, okay, let me take a picture, you know, or when they go,
that's
even
fine.
Go out to eat, and the, you know, that kind of stuff.
But. Yeah, but I just don't like the setup, the being invited by restaurants, and then the lights come out, you know, he's like, they start shooting with big lights, and the food gets cold, and nobody eats it.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of times when I shoot for Instagram, I take one picture. I like to talk to my kids about this. My kids also shoot for Instagram also. And I always tell them that, you know, it's the joke is, you know, it's shoot, eat, tweet. That's the order. Don't try to post it while you're eating and just take a picture and move on. So I like a lot of times I'll shoot a picture and then move on. I'll put my phone away. I'll take one or two photos and that's it. If I didn't get it, I don't post it.
That should be a hashtag, shoot, eat, tweet.
Shoot, eat, tweet.
T-shirts. I see a whole market.
That's the order. That's the order of things.
let me ask you. So I'm at your place in Brooklyn. Where did you grow up? How long have you been in New York?
I grew up on Long Island.
Okay.
Yeah. I grew up in Garden City, Long Island. I graduated high school and got out of there fast. Went right to college. Went to college in D.C. Went to Catholic U in D.C. But I grew up in, you know, classic suburban, you know, Long Island.
Yeah.
And, you know, the joke was that I was watching a friend of mine speak about his life and his hard knock life in Mill Basin. growing up in Mill Basin, all the gangsters and the tough stuff. And I'm thinking, I have no life story. I grew up drinking beer in one of the, in like the sand traps of one of the three country clubs in my town. You know, that wasn't so badass. But I mean, it also, I didn't have anything nearby that was nostalgic and like truly American.
Yeah,
I felt like it was a very different place. That didn't feel like, you know, that didn't feel like the rest of America. So when I started to actually get out, I drove across country for the first time when I was 19 years old.
Wow.
And it blew my mind. I read, I'll never forget this. I was a sophomore in college and I read Jack Kerouac's On the Road.
On the Road, yeah.
And I got literally a quarter way through the book. I looked at my roommate and I said, we have to get on the road. We got to do this. And of course, that didn't exist anymore. The book was written in the 40s.
Yeah.
But the notion of the freedom of the road called pretty strongly. And I did. At that point, I drove across the country once, and then I started doing the car service where I would drive people's cars across the country just to get on the road again.
Oh, really? Wow.
I did it about 5 times. And back and forth. Sometimes I would fly back. Sometimes I would drive one way and fly back. Sometimes I would take my car and drive back and forth. So I took about 5 trips before I was 21, back and forth across the country.
Wow.
And I was mind blown. My mind was absolutely blown. I couldn't believe how big it was. I mean, I grew up and I didn't travel much when I was a kid at all. Mm-hmm. So being out there in the country was a real eye-opener.
So you grew up in Long Island. Was there something that called you back? I mean, you know, it's New York. It's an amazing city. I mean, was it just that, or was it what made you, you know, plant your, you know?
I started working for, I took a job working for Buena Vista.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. My very first job, I was a PA. On a film called Paradise. I was actually a parking PA. I was locations assistant, and then a parking PA whenever the trucks came to town.
Sure.
But my job as location assistant was to watch a set overnight for the film Paradise.
Okay.
So there was a set up in the small town of McClellanville, South Carolina, and my job was to literally, I had to work 8 p.m. to 8 a.m. and just make sure nobody touched the set. It was a live set. They had taken the entire downtown and propped it out, decked it out.
Oh wow!
It was incredible. I mean, they had a special flag flying, and they built a fake front gas station.
Yeah,
completely stocked with, like, you know, soda machines and all. You know, there was like oil cans out on the. And my job was to stay awake all night and just make sure that like all the crazy rednecks didn't come and touch anything. The crazy rednecks, of course, became friends of mine and offered me all kinds of alcohol and drugs. It was a good time. It was a lot of fun, and I made some really, really close friendships with a lot of people down there.
Yeah.
And so they protected me, and I protected the set. And it was a nice setup.
Yeah.
That was my first job. So I worked at Buena Vista on Paradise, and then after that, I got a job offer to work at McCann Erickson. So I moved to New York. I moved back to New York and worked at McCann Erickson, and that was sort of the beginning of my career in New York. I got a job from there. I was actually laid off from – everybody got laid off in McCann at one point because they lost the Coke account.
Oh, wow.
That was a big deal.
Yeah.
And I had the great honor of being the first person to get laid off of, like, thousands. They were like – they put my hand on my shoulder. Man. George, I was an intern, too. I was a paid intern. I said, no, you're – sorry, I have to let you go. You're the first to go. But right away, at my going away party, someone offered me a job working at R. Greenberg Associates. I don't know if you remember R. Greenberg. They did the Superman titles, and they did the titles for Seven.
Yeah.
Titles for bunch of movies. They were known as a movie title house.
Yeah.
So I started working for them. All special effects. Crazy, like CGI, special early CGI on film. Like actually recorded onto film, which is so cool. We were just talking about that the other day. I was getting one of my computers repaired, and I walked in. There was a movie, Upright Moviola, in the Mac repair store, and I put it on Instagram. Does anybody know what this is?
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Like, all the old school guys, all the older guys were like, "Duh, Moviola." Who's seen one of these things in forever? We used to work on those.
Wow.
At R. Greenberg back. I'm old enough to know that, you know, I saw film. I shot film back in the day, and I saw it. You know?
That's awesome.
So I worked at R. Greenberg and then went from there working on Tabletop at R. Greenberg and then went to Greg Ramsey's studio after that. So.
Wow. What are some of the big changes you've seen to New York in general and just the food scene in New York?
Well, the rise of the cell phone
and
also bandwidth has changed everything. I mean, we started the Food Film Festival 13 years ago. There was really no way to watch films online.
Yeah.
Everything was all done through DVD. All of our submissions came in by DVD.
Mm-hmm.
We screened on DVD. Some of the stuff came in as Blu-ray, but nobody was really doing that. I think we did screen one film on film in a theater back in the day. Somebody actually had a final print on film.
Yeah.
We screened on D1 once. We had a D1, which is crazy back then. But nobody could really stream stuff. So I think what's really changed dramatically is that people have access to inexpensive cameras. Back in the – and also you couldn't shoot a film because you couldn't get a camera. You couldn't get a camera. It gives all – if you wanted to shoot HD to make a film look good, you couldn't find the camera. Mm-hmm. If you knew somebody, you could probably borrow one or rent one, but it was too expensive for people to make, you know, film for, you know, on HD. Everything's changed. Because the combination of the bandwidth changing on, you know, streaming plus the being able to have the technology in your hands has changed everything dramatically.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is a negative to that, though, as someone that also works in production, and it's just there's so many people trying to work in it? Do you think that because there's, you know, like great equipment available to anybody, that then they'll just hire somebody that really doesn't know what they're doing with, you know, that you can still get a great image as far as its quality, but maybe not as far as its framing or its, you know, lighting and all that that comes with cinematography?
Right. To me, it's all about storytelling. Yeah. And if you can tell a story with a camera, you're much better off than just pointing a camera at somebody and hoping you get something.
Sure.
So I think if this, it doesn't really matter to me that the technology has become, you know, available to everybody. Not everybody can shoot. Yeah. And people have to realize that. They know that they can shoot something, but you have to really have the story to back up what you're shooting.
Yeah. When it comes to the festival, I mean, it's just, it's such an awesome festival. So it's a multi-sensory festival.
It is a multi-sensory festival.
So if you can explain that to the listeners and just how that came to be.
Well, originally when I made Hamburger America, a friend of mine decided to show the film at his restaurant. He had an outdoor restaurant in Long Island City.
Okay.
And he said, why don't we make the burgers in your film?
Yeah.
And for the audience. And I said, that's a great idea. So we ended up actually making, I think, 3 or 4 of the 8 burgers in the film for the audience.
Wow.
And we thought, oh, it could be a bust. It was raining that night. We sold out. I think 200 tickets sold out, and people came in the pouring rain, ate the burgers, and freaked out. So I said to him, we need to do this again. We need to start a festival, obviously, and show my film, show Hamburger America, and do this again, and maybe I'll find other filmmakers. That's how it was born at that point. The Food Film Fest is a multi-sensory experience.
Yeah.
And the idea is that you, as you're watching something on the screen, and you're thinking to yourself, oh, I gotta have that. It shows up in your seat in front of you. And
that's amazing. That's the biggest. That is the biggest thing. Like, what I mean, when there are the, you know, those films with great food scenes, or, you know, you're watching it, or I mean, if you're watching, there's so many food travel shows, you know, from, I mean, obviously yours, and then I mean Bourdain with his, you know, with Parts Unknown, and Phil Rosenthal with, you know, Everybody Feed Phil now, and all those. You know, you're watching those and you just get so hungry. So it's either, you know, most of the time you eat beforehand, or I mean, if you're at home, you can have something in front of you, but that's the perfect.
Yeah, we tell people don't eat before you come to the Food and Film Fest.
Yeah.
That's a bad idea because we will fill you up. And when you're watching films, we'll show, for example, like 7, 8, 9 short films in a one hour program.
Okay.
So you basically are eating a meal in your seat. Sometimes we'll start out with a few films about drinks or appetizers. Then we'll start out with, well, in the middle of the program will be films about proteins and main course type films. And then we'll end with a few films about sweets. And you are sort of tasting a meal in your seat. But we time it, though. Everything is timed, I mean, right down to almost to the second at the Food Film Fest. So your experience, you walk away with an experience that you really, it's a very fulfilling experience where when you do say yourself, I've got to eat that, we have timed that before. We watch the films ourselves, obviously, and we say, what point in the film do you want to eat this? And then we have a committee, and we all agree that's the point. We write down, okay, we are 1 minute and 27 seconds in. Okay, there you go. So their food is released a few seconds before that moment happens. So as it's happening, you're grabbing a tray. It's coming down the aisle. You're eating
it.
Oh, you smell it coming. It's really amazing. And the difference of what we do and everyone else, people have tried to replicate what we do in other parts of the world, all over the place. And we're just crazy enough to pull this kind of stuff off because to get it right, it's easy to get wrong. If a food comes out and it's supposed to be hot and it's people pick it up and it's cold, or vice versa, it's room temperature and it should be cold, then the experience is lost. So we have a crew. I mean, any given festival night, we will have roughly 120 to 130 different people working for us to make sure that all those moments are happening. Hot food comes out hot. Cold food comes out cold. You know, if it's supposed to look like a certain way, it looks a certain way.
Yeah.
Tastes a certain way. And we don't just make the food. We make some of the food ourselves if we can. But for the most part, if you see the chef on screen, that chef is actually in the back.
Wow. Okay.
Preparing the food for us.
Yeah.
Because they want to get it right. And now at this point, the festival's got a place where chefs do really want to get involved. They want to break through with some new restaurant or new idea. They come to us. And we work with them to make all of our dreams come true. And they're actually back there making the food. And then, of course, the end of the film, if the chef's in the house, bring the chef on stage. Yeah. He or she's on stage and waving to the audience. People can't believe it. They can't, like, wow, I just ate food from the chef and I saw the thing being made. And, oh, my God. So it's a lot of fun. And we do that multiple times a night. And any given night, if we have 350 people in the audience, we'll serve 4,000 tastes just in the theater alone. Yeah. It's amazing. It's truly incredible. It goes on and on.
No, it's such an amazing experience. Everyone should, you know, go to it if they can get a ticket, because I mean it's always right in the early mid October, right?
It's always the third week of October.
Third week of October.
Yeah, we follow food and wine.
We
have wine and food.
Yeah,
and then we're before Star Chefs. We're in the Star Chefs conference, whatever. So we're in between the two.
Yeah. It's such a great time of year in New York just to experience, just to watch and then stuff your face, and it's amazing. I mean, I won't call it an epiphany, but I always loved food. The first job I ever had was working at a deli, and then I've just always been surrounded by food, and then going into production as well. And then I think I just had a moment that I'm like, you know what, I love both film and food, because they're both productions. I think just the time management of it all, and that it takes a team to create something amazing.
You know? I mean, people do not, they try to replicate what we do, like I was saying, but they can't. It's just too much work.
Yeah.
You have to have a screw loose to do what we do. And the people I work with it's one of the greatest teams I've ever worked with, and it's constantly changing and building. We like to say, you know, when someone joins the team, we like to say they got on the bus. Like, you know, Ken Kesey's bus. So the idea that they smoke what we're smoking, and they're on the bus with us now, because you can only be crazy to do what we do.
How large is that team usually for the festival?
We have a year round. We have it's only myself, my business partner Seth Unger, who's the executive producer. I'm the director of the festival. And then we have one other person on staff as well year round. And then beyond that, it starts to build right about now. Starting in about May, we pick up. Start to add more people, and then by the time the festival week is happening, we're at about 135 people. So it's a big team.
And when do you start? When do people start entering films? And when do you start
the food? The film submissions start the day after the festival.
Oh, wow!
So we start right away, so we can have a full year to, you know, see films.
That's great.
Yeah, and people know it's not a rolling submission, but it's definitely an early. The submission starts. It's almost a full year. Well, that's the half a year, because we see the films in about May. And that's whenever we have a committee that actually watches the films and culls them and makes sure that they're sometimes people send, like, you know, weird, you know, like stabbing and bloody food films. We don't want that.
Yeah.
So people send, we have a food porn category. People actually send, like, pornography. So I was like, no, we can't. we stay away from all that kind of stuff. We have sponsors to deal with. And, you know.
So let's see. What have we covered? We covered filmmaker. Then obviously, food filmmaker, author, teacher, director of a festival, and also I love that you ended up because of, you know, your documentary and then the book and TV series you created. I mean, what do we want to call that? Food, like a product line, right?
Yes, but I wasn't going to make a product that represented me until I was going to make something myself and do it really well. And when I had Burgerland, the TV show. People wanted me to make aprons and spatulas, and I said, nah, you know. So they wanted to make everything in China and make sure that it was cheap and they could make tons of it. And I said, I'm actually not interested in that at all. And they were kind of shocked. I just don't want to do it. I think if you put my name on something, it's got to be fantastic, and I don't really care about money, so sorry. They were all kind of shocked. But then along came the need for a heavy spatula, because once I made the cookbook about 3 years ago, I would go on news shows, and I'd tour with the book, and people wanted me to make burgers. Well, obviously, you know how to make burgers, because you forget the guidebook. You've actually written a cookbook on how to make burgers. So, yeah, I guess I can make burgers. So people wanted to see a live demo. So I would go on news shows, and then realizing that I had all the wrong equipment. And I went through, I started to change the way I cooked. And I would look at what my contemporaries were doing. I'd look at what these hamburger places that I was talking about in both my books were doing, and I started to design equipment. And the first thing I designed was a spatula that was designed specifically just for smashing, called Smashula.
Smashula.
Yeah. And we put the first one out last February, and we sold 12 of them at $220 a piece, because they're very expensive to produce.
Wow.
Yeah. And we sold 12 in about 2 hours. So they were gone. And we sold another next 24 in about 2 days. And I realized I better, you know, we built production, started having production issues right away because it's a very expensive thing to produce. It's produced right in Brooklyn, right here in Brooklyn, you know, by metal workers in Brooklyn who, you know, who have high rents just like I do.
Yeah.
It's not made in China. And people are like, I can't believe you're selling a Spezza for $220. Like, well, we make zero money on this thing. You know, we're just trying to get it out there.
I mean, just looking at it and holding it before it, it'll last. Oh, like, that's the one thing. You look at it. I mean, that's something that goes along with a lot of cooking equipment and apparel. Like, if you buy something, I mean, like a cast iron pan,
yeah,
it's your best friend for life. Yeah, exactly. If you take care of it.
Well, we also put your name is also etched on it, so that's the
okay.
So you get a unique serial number, you can put your company logo on it or whatever. I'm not trying to make an ad, I'm just saying that. But the point is, this thing, it's an heirloom, this thing is designed to last forever, and it really is. It's made of 12 gauge steel, and it would last forever. But I was trying to, I wanted to make sure that I was making something that people could really, you know, could keep for life.
Yeah.
That was important to me. That's of course, awesome. Then we had production issues and had to shut down for a little while, but we're getting back online again.
Well, at least it's right here in Brooklyn so that you can go over there and check it out and see how it's going along. It's pretty convenient.
Exactly.
Did I read correctly that you're working on a Broadway musical?
Yeah.
Can we talk about it at all? Or can we
sure.
Just, okay.
I mean, I'm working on a lot of things. I'm working on a new TV show. That's my next one. That's where I'm pitching a new show.
Great.
I see, not to like give myself a big head, but there's been no real host-driven food stuff happening after, you know, everybody seems to have, you know, sort of fallen off.
Yeah.
Netflix is doing a ton of food content right now.
Yeah.
And so we're out there pitching stuff, so we'll see what happens. I mean, I've been a guest on The Burger Show, which is First We Feast.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been amazing because The Burger Show, I didn't realize after the first episode aired, that suddenly I had a mini fan base that was way south of my normal demographic. My normal demographic tends to be like, you know, mid-40s, overweight guys with glasses, which is great. I don't mind those guys at all. No girls, sorry. But I suddenly realized that by being on The Burger Show for First We Feast, I had a 14-year-old kid walk up to me and say, hey, man, you're the burger guy. I saw you on The Burger Show. So I had this sudden, like, this new demographic that was between, like, 14 and 25, which I had never had before. So that was pretty exciting. So because of that, I'm getting back into it again. I'm going to do a show again. And I have no book going on. I have no book deals happening right now, and I want to do a show. But the Broadway musical was not a joke. People thought it was a joke. It actually wasn't. I would like to somehow produce a Broadway musical for sure. You know,
that's awesome.
I believe that there's the Great American Story needs to be told about the hamburger.
Yeah,
which is simply I'll give you the broad strokes is that it's about a small three stool diner in somewhere America that discovers after the end of the first act that it has to move, it has to close down.
Oh, okay.
And what is the importance of holding on to the things you love? Is it important to keep that alive, or is it important to let it go? And by a bunch of different plot twists, you know, it's saved. Because we all want our icons to be saved. So, but it's going to be a comedy. It's going to be a comedy and a musical. And I think the idea was that a friend of mine got involved who was brightly pointed out that if you're dealing with three generations of people in this restaurant on stage, you've got three generations of music. You've got the stuff in the 60s and 70s. You've got the current hip hop. You've got old, like, you know, grandpa's music. So you get to mix it up in a way, which is kind of cool, and keep it very, very American, very American proud.
Yeah, which is something clear. I mean, you just see. I mean, Broadway always has such different musicals from, obviously, Hamilton, and, I mean, it's a story of, you know, during the revolutionary times where they're, you know, using hip-hop music to tell that story, and then you have a comedy about Mormons, and it's, you know, that's Trey Parker, you know, doing
exactly.
that.
Exactly, yeah.
But I love that. I mean, I love music, and so the fact that you're saying that you could cover, I feel like there's no other show that. You know,
well, that's why it'd be a musical, not just a play, but it'd be a musical because I think people get generally more excited about musicals, not just straight up Broadway plays.
Yeah.
I think it has to have the element of dance and music, which is great.
Yeah.
But also on top of that, what we would do to add another facet to it, which no one ever does, is food.
Because it's
a three stool diner. There's going to be the sizzling sound of burgers happening, obviously, and the smell of burgers. And intermission would be all about, you know, burgers. So in a way, it's the knowledge that we've gained from working at the Food Film Fest will feed into the success, hopefully, of this musical. Now, musicals take a long time to produce.
Sure.
So we'll see.
Can I ask you, what do you think of the? I mean, movie theaters have changed, and you have like your Alamo Draft House, or your even your bigger ones like what are they called, iPix and stuff like that. Yeah. All the theaters that serve food. What do you think of the current food realm in like the movie theaters, and where do you think it can, I mean, I'm sure it obviously can improve, but do you have any thoughts on that?
No, not really. I mean, I've been to Alamo Drafthouse a bunch. Yeah. You know, I actually screened a film in Alamo Drafthouse, the original one in Austin way back.
Okay.
Not a food film. I just filmed a regular feature film back then. Back in the day, it was a lot. This goes back almost 20 years. South by Southwest. they were actually one of the theaters for South by Southwest before they were
anything huge. Huge, yeah.
It works actually somehow. You know, I think it's nice to be able to eat while you're watching a movie, you know? Yeah. I think generally the only problem is people think when they go to a movie they're really just gonna eat candy and popcorn.
Yeah.
So I think it's hard to get people out of that. I'd say the one added benefit is alcohol. That's a good move. If you could just serve alcohol and popcorn and candy, I'd be happy.
Yeah, the first Alamo Drafthouse I ever went to was they have one up in Yonkers, and now they have one in Brooklyn, and now they're opening up one by One World, and so it's just a great theater in that sense that you can show up, I mean, whenever you want, and you can just go in there. I mean, you could just go there and have a beer if you wanted.
Which I think is the food's expensive and not that great, unfortunately. Sorry, guys.
Yeah.
But really, the bang for buck, I think, is without a doubt being able to have like a craft beer while watching a movie. That's kind of brilliant, actually.
Yeah, and have it from like all like local breweries, too. I think that's what the special thing is. You seem like a guy that appreciates community, and so that's just something pretty awesome.
And beer helps.
Beer never hurts. Well, beer helps.
Beer helps.
I was gonna say it never hurts, but it always helps.
It helps.
So let's talk about a couple of just maybe some food movie scenes. I asked you what are some of your favorites. You said Tampopo and Diva. I've seen Tampopo. I haven't seen Diva.
Diva's not a food film. Diva's actually a drama. It's a French drama. It was made in the 80s. I saw it by accident. I think my French stepsister was watching it. And I was watching it with her when I was a kid and kind of amazed by it. But it's a French drama.
Yeah.
It's a thriller. Not a drama. It's definitely not a drama. I'm sorry. It's a thriller. It's like a cops and robbers type thriller. There's a bad guy who wears an earpiece all the time. He's getting balls. The bad guy, or like the stool, the guy who's like the guy, the go-between, wears like a little earbud.
Yeah.
And you assume he's getting like, you know, reports from like his boss, you know, it's like a classic, those old like white earbuds in one ear. And he's always sort of talking to somebody and talking to himself. You realize at the end of the film when he actually dies that he's been listening to organ grinder music the entire time.
Oh, wow.
it's totally weird.
French filmmaker.
I think he falls down like a well, and the camera goes into him, and it goes into his face, and then goes to the earbud, it's fallen out on the sidewalk, it's so freaky, it's so weird. Anyway, it's not a food film at all, but there is a really good food scene where the good guy. Who's I think is a pedophile because he has this young girl roller skating around his apartment. I couldn't quite follow what was going on, but he calls it the best pain avec beurre, which is basically it's butter, bread and butter. he takes a baguette and slices it open, and he's describing what he's doing as he's doing it. And it's just that made it. Of course, when someone's describing food for you, it always makes food taste better. So when he's describing the buttering of a bread, you realize it's got to be good. It's French butter. It's French bread. It's got to be fantastic. Yeah. So that's any time someone describes what they're doing, it always makes it that much more flavorful. I think, you know, just like in Tampopo is one of those films
it's such a great film. I love that. You know, I mean. That film, you know, it idolized. It was during a time that, you know, of idolizing spaghetti westerns, and I think they ended up calling it a ramen western. You know, the Japanese flair, and it's just such a great movie.
It's a great film, and we tried forever to get it at the Food Film Fest, and I realized that we were never going to find it. We're never going to be able. Everyone knew the film was a cult film.
Yeah.
We couldn't find the rights to screen it, and we realized later on that it was impossible. So we gave up. And then right when we gave up, we became friends with a guy in Brooklyn who was just a dad at a friend's school, someone's dad, and he worked for the Criterion Collection.
Oh, okay.
And he had told us that he had the film, and we said let's screen it. And he said we're done, and so we showed the film. And obviously, we served great food during the film. I actually saw him again a few weeks ago at a party. I said, I have to ask you, how did you guys get the film? He had a great line. He said, it took 11 years and lots of maple candy. I said, what are you talking about? This is the long-sorted tale. I won't get into that. But at this point, the director's widow had the rights to the film. Or she owned the film. Didn't think she even knew she had the rights. And they basically, it took a lot of coercing. A lot of meetings, and for some reason, maple candy goes a long way in Japan.
Okay.
I think it is. Good to know. Yeah. Patience and maple candy.
And maple candy.
You can get a film out of somebody. But the film, so they restored the print to the film. Oh. They took the original negative. So they restored the original. They actually went back to the negative to make a new interpositive, whatever it's called, and made a beautiful digital version from the negative. That's why it looks so gorgeous. So gorgeous.
Yeah.
And so we were showing it on our 50-foot screen in Times Square for the Food Film Fest, and just to see Tampopo in that kind of resolution on a big screen was just mind blowing. Yeah. We had a great time with it. And so during the film, we served about 9 or 10 different types of food.
Yeah.
One of the best moments, though, my favorite moment by far in that film in terms of serving food, is there's a scene where there's a guy running. Remember the scene with the guy running? You don't know what he's running to. And he's running to home. He's running home. He bursts in the door, and there's a doctor sort of administering last rites to his wife who's lying on the floor. And the kids are kind of sitting at the dining room table not knowing what to do.
Yeah.
And he grabs her and says, "Get up, woman."
Yeah, he demands for her. Yeah.
"Make dinner."
Yeah.
And so because she's, the husband is telling her what to do, she rights herself, walks into the kitchen, and starts to pull out a wok and starts to make this very simple stir-fry, pork stir-fry. And she stumbles into the dining room and drops it on the table and dies, keels over and dies.
Dead, yeah.
We served the stir-fry to the audience. Just as she's dying. And a woman came up to me after the screening crying. Joy, tears of joy, saying, "You served a dead woman's food." That was unbelievable. It was true. I mean, I don't think people were ready for that. And there was a scene we could have served like this sort of floppy noodle scene before that.
Yeah,
a scene after that we could have served something else. But one of the people we worked with the festival said, "I think you need to. This is the moment. Is right here. This woman basically making this woman's last meal."
You weren't going to have two people sharing an egg yolk between their do that. We recreate talked about that scene. Oh,
we talked about everything. We talked about the prawn and the vinegar, that whole God on the belly. We couldn't recreate that.
That is food eroticism at its finest,
highest point right there. Yeah, that's incredible.
I'm gonna have to pick. So that is on Criterion. Is part of the Criterion Collection.
It is. Yeah,
I'm gonna have to pick that up. But I've only seen it via like a streaming service. Yeah.
Back then we only had it on videotape. We had I had some pirate videotape. With just said Tampopo written out with a black Sharpie.
There's a young Ken Watanabe in that film. It definitely
so is. Good. He is so good. Oh, by the way, it's also that all those scenes with the ramen. Nobody ever covered ramen the way they did.
Yeah.
And the way he described the very first scene where he's talking about how to eat ramen, that great scene where he says you tap the pork to show appreciation, and then once you've tapped it, you move it out of the way. Because you're going to eat that later. You want to show, you want to give it some more space. Give it some space. That was such a great scene.
Well, ramen's that stuff that's dry in a cup and then you put hot water, right?
Sure.
As a drunk college student, right?
That's honestly, Tampopo was the reason that we all learned that it was something more than just. And we all thought it was just cup, some crap.
Yeah.
It is a great scene.
As a filmmaker, I just want to ask you. What are some of your favorite films? Not even food films, just food and films in general.
Well, again, there's not a whole lot of great food films out there. Unless you think of Big Night, The Cook, the Thief, The Chef, and His Lover, whatever. Those are like Water for Chocolate. These are films that are they're okay. If I see them once, I'm happy. But other films, I feel embarrassed even saying this, but one of my all-time favorite films is Caddyshack. I could watch the film over and over and over again. I like the classics. I like, On the Waterfront. I'm a big fan of Lawrence of Arabia. One of my all-time favorite films is a film by the Coen brothers called Blood Simple.
Yeah, wow.
That was a great film. That film blew my mind. It really, the fact that it's one of those films where you're in lawless Texas, and there's no law. There's hardly a cop, never a court scene.
Yeah.
Everyone's sort of on their own. Everyone's fending for themselves in modern-day Texas, which seemed kind of weird and outlawish to me. Mm-hmm. And that was a great film. I think they did a great job with that. There's one great line where Frances McDormand keeps using the line, "I ain't done nothing funny." Which, of course, she has. It's a great scene. It's a great scene. It's a great film with every scene just builds on the next. I think it's one of the most perfect films I've ever seen is Blood Simple, for sure.
Well, I mean, but that's the great thing. I mean, in other episodes, like, we'll highlight a food. I just wanted to talk to you so much about your career, but, like, we'll highlight a food-centric movie, but then I'll have people talk, like, a random food scene. So we've talked, you know, like, there's great food scenes and, like, Goodfellas, you know, the stir in the sauce and that kind
of,
you know.
Yeah, the slicing of the garlic.
You'll
never forget that.
Yes, exactly. So there are, like, great scenes in movies, but there really aren't a lot of food, you know, driven films.
Big Night and Tampopo are the two biggest ones I can think of right now.
Have you ever thought, like, you want to make a narrative-driven...
Of course, yeah. I mean, like the musical, you know.
Yeah.
I would love to make a story of a small-town diner that is going out of business. And what do you do? Because I got to tell you, unfortunately, it happens all the time.
Yeah.
You know, small-town diners go out of business all the time. The idea with the play, and it would be the film also, was that... This happens every day pretty much. I'm seeing a lot of it. So the story would actually be made up of details from 200 of my favorite restaurants that are out there that have weird hours or have some guy, the delivery guy, who's also happens to be a luchero, like, you know, a Mexican wrestler. You know, the stories are out there. They exist. And so I want to put all those stories into one hamburger place, some super hamburger joint that has all the crazy stories all blended into one. People will be able to pick out, like, oh, yeah, that's our burger, or that's the girl that works for us, you know. Well, those are our stools.
Well, it's great because it would be so relatable to so many different businesses and people and their stories.
I mean, Baghdad Cafe was one of those films also that was fantastic, and it would be similar. I think it would be similar to Baghdad Cafe in its feeling. I remember Baghdad. I don't know if you remember this movie, Baghdad Cafe. Remember this at all?
No.
It's a Route 66 diner in the middle of nowhere, and it's a bunch of just stories about people who go through the place. You know?
Yeah.
And it's a narrative film. But we'll see. I'd love to be able to make a film. I'd like to make a real food film. I'm actually working on specifically a food narrative I'd love to make. But I'm also working on another film this year that's going to be a new thing, a new approach for me, because I had a weird moment where one of my favorite restaurants closed. It had nothing to do with burgers at all. It was a gyro restaurant called Gyro 2.
Okay.
And what happened was I would go there all the time, but I wouldn't tell anybody. Because to me, it was kind of a guilty pleasure. And I would go there literally for 25 years and didn't tell anybody. Maybe even longer, actually. It was right. It was in what's it called? Right across from the Garden.
Okay.
Whatever that neighborhood is, right on 7th Avenue.
Yeah.
It was kind of a gross neighborhood, which was getting better. I mean, back when I was going there first, it was really bad. It was just people went there just to get on the train and go back to Long Island.
Yeah.
Or go to Rangers games, or go see the Grateful Dead or something. And I was actually on my way to go see the Grateful Dead revival band, whatever the hell it was, with a friend. Turned the corner, went to Gyro 2 to get a gyro, and it was closed. And I almost cried. I was like, what the hell just happened? No one told me this was happening. It's over. And there was in the window was a sign that says, I'm sorry, after 38 years we've closed the doors. Actually, more than that. But here's our white sauce recipe. So I took a picture of it.
Yeah.
And I posted on Instagram saying, you know, this is what happens when you don't pay attention. But if you think that your favorite place is never going to close, it will.
Yeah.
So I just plead to get people to just not try to save your places, but just to appreciate them while they exist. You know, you go to your restaurants and know they're not going to last. They can't. It's impossible.
Yeah.
No, nothing lasts forever. But while you're there, appreciate how great they are. You know, really be part of the zeitgeist. Be part of what's happening and, you know, take and appreciate it. That was the whole post. And then all of a sudden, after all these comments on the post saying, people are big chefs saying, oh, I used to go there all the time and not tell anybody. I went there all the time before Rangers games to get a gyro. The place was so dirty, but I loved it. Which actually wasn't dirty. And then one of the last comments was, my dad owned that restaurant. He sold it to a partner. And it happened to be the guy, one of the owners from Speedy Romeo, which is a very well-known restaurant in New York.
Yeah.
So the story, I'm not going to get into the whole story now because I don't want to blow the movie. But I'm making a film about finding the dad, finding this guy's dad, and talking to him about doing a pop-up and opening up again just for one night only.
That's awesome.
And so we'll show that at the Food Film Fest and have a pop-up at the Food Film Fest. I get to bring back the white sauce.
Oh, well, I was going to say the white thing. Yeah.
I can't wait. And the stories are intense. They're so good. So I'm going to make a film about, you know, about regretting, you know, not being able to talk about my guilty pleasure.
Yeah, get some closure.
Massive closure. Can't wait.
I feel that, I mean, just filmmaking in general, but with food, it can just be so cathartic, right?
Yeah.
That's the big thing with...
Well, we all eat. We all eat, and I like to say we all like to eat, you know, we all eat. We all definitely want to eat well. So the more information that's out there that you can, you know, triangulate, is it fresh, is it frozen, is it, you know, is it worth going, is it closed, you know, what is it open, that's all very important for the food experience, you know. But people do want to eat, they want to eat well. That's what the Food Film Fest is all about, honestly.
That's awesome. Well, to finish up, I have a segment called Gut Instincts, and it's just kind of, you know, like a little, not timed, but a speed round of just whatever comes to you first as far as these questions. So
go for it.
All right. Well, do you have a favorite fast food? Before, I mean, you
well,
have a fast
I mean,
food burgers,
honestly,
but,
burgers. Burgers is definitely burgers. I mean, it's, without a doubt, hamburgers are definitely my favorite fast food.
But any specific establishment, I should say?
If I'm in the Midwest, it is Steak and Shake.
Okay.
It's a great fast food burger, unquestionably. But it depends. I mean, if I'm on the East Coast, West Coast, it all depends. I like to say that my favorite burgers are the ones that are in my book that I'm closest to.
Yeah. Go-to alcoholic beverage?
I got to be honest, beer.
Beer?
Yeah.
Any particular one right now that's...
I drink a lot of IPA. I like IPAs, but I also like, depends on the season, you know?
Yeah,
I drink IPAs in the winter, I drink pilsners and lagers in the summer.
Yeah.
So.
Nice. Favorite childhood snack?
I got to say, probably the goldfish.
The goldfish?
I ate a lot of goldfish
when I was
a kid. I
love fishes because they're so delicious.
So it's nonstop. I ate a lot of goldfish as a kid.
Nice.
That's a good one.
Sweet or savory?
It depends, but I would say I probably err on the side of savory.
Nice.
Yeah.
Favorite food city, domestic and international?
My favorite food city domestically is unquestionably Charleston. And I have a lot of family in Charleston, and there's so much going on. There's so much food there, it's ridiculous. I mean, you sort of can't. You can
they
go there
just
for
had a food,
food
festival recently, right?
Last week they had the food and wine was there.
Oh, it was food and wine.
And Charleston Food and Wine happens. A couple weeks ago, 2 weeks ago. It's a great food city, and that actually kind of ruins the city. I've been to the festival before, but only to go to the festival. You can't eat at restaurants during that because everything's taken up. No one has real service going on, but it is unquestionably one of the greatest food cities in the country by far. There's a lot going on in Nashville, a lot going on in Atlanta, a lot going on in other parts of the country, but I still, bang for buck, I think it's flying into Charleston and eating for 3 days is kind of priceless.
Awesome.
You know, internationally, that's a good question. I mean, there's not, you know, things are changing all over the world fast. But I love going to Sao Paulo. I'm there a lot now.
Yeah.
And every time I go there, I'm always amazed that my friends and hosts always take me to different places every time.
Yeah.
Old school places, brand new places, and it's always really good. The food is so fresh and pure in Sao Paulo. You know, there's not a whole lot of there's a lot of processed food.
Yeah.
But it's in a different place. You know, it's not really shared with the masses the way we do in America.
Yeah.
You don't find, you know, it's different. It seems like there's less access to processed food in Sao Paulo than there is in America, which is kind of a bummer, obviously. And you don't have to look very hard to find great food in Sao Paulo.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And it's also, they have great traditional foods. You know, they have great feijoada, they've got coxinha, and all these great foods that you really can't get in America.
Yeah, I would definitely love to. I've never been anywhere in South America, only Asia and Europe besides.
You need
North
a trip
America.
There for sure.
Yeah. Favorite cuisine?
Wow. I mean, ooh, that's a good question. That's a tough one to answer because, honestly, probably Southern food, you know?
Yeah.
I think Southern food has been changing a lot, and it's exciting to see what happens with Southern food as it changes. I mean, I grew up on Southern food because of my mom. My mom's from South Carolina, so I love grits.
Yeah.
I'm a huge fan of grits. I'm a huge fan of collard greens. I'm a big fan of all of these things that are...
Same here.
Yeah, good, like, you know, just stick to the bone.
Yeah.
stick to your, what's the phrase? stick to your ribs? Anyway, I'm a big fan of Southern food. Big fan of Southern. I'd have to say Southern food, probably.
This isn't a question that's part of this, but now that knowing that you're a big fan of Southern food, is there any particular restaurant in the New York City area that you're like, ooh, they do it right for some?
No. I mean, I spent a lot of time eating in South Carolina, and I have relatives who have restaurants in South Carolina, and they get it right. And a lot of it's just about sticking to tradition, like anything else, sticking to tradition and also using fresh ingredients. And you've got that down, no matter what your tradition is, whether it's a hamburger, whether it's something in, you know, if you're making, you know, Irish food, stick to tradition and keep it fresh, and you can't go wrong, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Guilty pleasure food.
I would say without a doubt the gyro.
Gyro, yeah.
Yeah, I'll probably get one today. likely. I'm a big fan of. I love that mystery lamb meat, spiced, whatever it is, cut off the thing. I'm a big fan of the gyro. Yeah.
Favorite condiment.
People are going to freak out about this, but I like mayonnaise.
Yeah.
I'm a big fan of...
huge jar of...
But even before that, honestly, this has nothing to do with my sponsors. But I've always been a big fan of mayonnaise. And I'll tell you why. Because mayonnaise is one of those foods that was invented. It didn't come about by a single ingredient or two.
Sure. Yeah.
It's science. And some genius figured out if you emulsify this and do that and add this, you end up with this aioli mayonnaise. Which is it's extraordinarily complex and not easy to make.
Yeah.
So I think mayonnaise, if you've had really good mayonnaise, it's kind of a life changer.
Awesome. What's the last thing you ate?
last thing I ate was a smoked oyster last night. I smoked some oysters last night.
Nice.
Which is great because it's like the easiest, stupidest thing to do. You shuck oysters.
Yeah.
You keep the liquor, the liquid inside, it's called liquor. You keep them, you know, face up inside the shell. You actually cut the abductor muscle on the bottom. You put them on your grill. You do a indirect heat. You put coals off to one side.
Yeah.
You line up your grill with all of them, and then it's a very low heat thing. And you throw wood chips onto the fire,
yeah.
And you close it up and come back in an hour, and they are perfect. They are smoky and brown.
I'm gonna have to try that.
It's so easy. It's so good. And we put some hot sauce on the last night. You can put a little bit of butter. You know, I did a curry butter, and smoked oysters is just like, it's mind-blowing, so.
I mean, you're a Long Island guy, you guys got your oysters.
That's the thing, we got oysters, but also clams. I'm a big fan of the clam.
Ooh,
One of my all-time favorite things to eat in the summertime is a fresh little neck.
Yeah, goal of mine, I mean, it's not the hardest thing in the world, but I would love to go to like a traditional clam bake someday.
Yeah, like, they're fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would be your last meal?
Ooh. I'll be honest, not a hamburger.
How many hamburgers do you think? Like, I mean, maybe it was easier to say, like, on like yearly average. I mean,
average is hard to say, but I probably in the last 18, 20 years, I've probably eaten like 12,000 to 14,000 burgers.
Easily. Wow.
Just in the name of research. I mean, some of them are small, you know?
Yeah.
Some of them are huge, but it depends. You know, I'll eat during research when I'm actually working on a book or a TV show or something, I'll eat roughly 25 in a week.
Yeah.
Just for research, but then on normal weeks I'm not working on anything. I'll eat one or two a week. I need to eat at least one a week. it's very important to me. But my last meal, I would hope would be a one of my all time favorite things to eat is a bacon sandwich,
okay.
Good crispy bacon, on white toast with mayonnaise. And that's it. And a chocolate milkshake.
So not a BLT, just the no L, no T.
No L, no T, just bacon.
It's the bacon.
Something pretty magical about bacon, white toast, and mayonnaise.
Yeah.
And then a chocolate shake.
Do you prefer to dine in or dine out? Like cooking for yourself or going to...
I like them both equally. It's hard to pick one because I cook in all the time. I cook for my kids all the time. And I experiment, you know, don't tell them, but I experiment on them all the time. I serve the food they would normally eat, and I'll take the same meal we've made 100 times, and I'll make it a different way every single time. And I have lots of notes, and I'm working on another cookbook right now.
It's awesome.
It is not just about hamburgers. Because I want to be able to, I've got a lot of food to share. I've done a lot of testing, I mean, years and years of testing, mostly on my kids and my friends. My friends go, oh, did you change this? Like, yeah, I sure did. Write that down. They liked it. So I like dining in. I like eating in a lot. I cook all the time. I love being in the kitchen to cook. But I also like to eat out. I'm like, if it's a good restaurant, I'm there. I love there's so much to do out there. We live in New York City where there's, you know, there's almost too much to, it's overwhelming. There's too much to eat here.
Yeah. I read it was a New York Times article about you and like your typical Sunday.
Oh, yeah.
And I love, what was it called?
The family,
the game, eat the world.
We do this. We love it. You know,
yeah.
We didn't do it for a couple of years. I was getting divorced, and we actually didn't do it for a while because things were confusing, obviously. But we were back on again.
Yeah.
And it's a basic game where you basically spin a globe.
Yeah.
And one person is the stop, and one person is the finger. So you put your finger, you hover your finger over one part. You have to choose ahead of time. You're going to use, is it southern hemisphere, northern hemisphere?
Sure.
Low on the equator, high on the equator. And you basically hover your finger over, and then you put your finger down whenever someone stops the globe. And you go to the restaurant that serves that country's cuisine.
That's awesome.
And so sometimes we land in the ocean and start over again, but most of the time China is huge. We keep hitting China. We've already been to China, Mexico. We've gone to Sweden. We've gone to What did we do last week? Last week we tried to do Morocco. We went to a Moroccan food restaurant. It was closed, unfortunately. We had to bail and something else. So, but it's a lot of fun. Family is world. Yeah,
that's a great game, and that's just that's just a great way to get your kids. I mean, that's a big part of growing up is trying food then, and like. Kids can be pretty picky, so that's a good way to just expand their horizons.
It's great, but also they also expand their knowledge of what the city has to offer ethnically, which I think that, you've got the kids that are going to a nice school, and they're like, there's white kids living in a white neighborhood. Yeah. You want to make sure that they actually are not, they're not just growing up in a bubble, that they actually do get out and see stuff. A couple weeks ago, we went to this place called Blue Sky? I guess it's called Blue Sky. It was an Indonesian restaurant in Flushing. I can't remember what it was now, but it was fantastic. Yeah. It was mind blowing. It really was. It was one of those experiences. Nobody was like us, and I hate to say it, in the restaurant.
Sometimes that's when you know it's going to be really good.
Yeah, exactly. You know it's going to be good whenever you're the only person who's not from the neighborhood. Yeah. But we looked up what was the best, and the New York Times had done a piece on it a while ago. And, that was we went there because we landed on Indonesia on the globe. So
that's awesome. Yeah. That's such a fun way to find new places to eat or just new cuisines as well. What would be your spirit food? I mean, you are the burger expert. I mean, are burgers is a burger what like encompasses what you think like is what like who you are and what you know?
Unquestionably, people have obviously associated me with the hamburger. Yeah. So it's kind of hard to get away from that.
Sure.
But yeah, it does. I mean, the reason I've stuck with it this long is that people say to me all the time, you must be so sick of hamburgers. I said, no, actually, I'm not because. As I get further into the hamburger, the more passionate I get about it. So it really it's become, I would say, it just keeps growing. It keeps getting bigger and bigger. And the deeper I go into the world of hamburger, the better it gets.
And I love, just watching content of yours and other people interviewing you, your onion burger, I mean, just the smashed onion burger.
Yeah.
That's just, I mean, such a great, I mean, yeah.
That's the burger I make most at events because the way I described it is it's the burger that is greater than the sum of its parts, unquestionably. You make this burger, and it only has a few parts. It's five elements. It's got a bun, beef, cheese, salt, onion. That's it.
Wow, yeah.
And but those five elements done correctly, actually executed correctly, make a burger that people say, okay, there's some sauce, something in the meat. What's going on here? What kind of bun is this?
Yeah.
Did you butter the bun? And none of those things have happened. The bun actually rides on top of the burger as it's flipped, and it becomes steamy, like White Manna.
Yeah.
I got that method came from White Manna, New Jersey. In fact, the actual, if you look at the way they flip the burger over, theirs is reverse from what I do. I have a different method for pinching and pulling the bun off. It's reverse what they do. Their cheese ends up on the bottom, which I don't like. They do. It's weird. I'm like, why is the cheese on the bottom?
Yeah.
This is the way they've done it forever, But it is definitely unquestionably greater than the sum of its parts, and people want to know what the magic is.
Yeah.
So it's also it cooks fast. I can cook it now if I'm on a TV show and I'm making burgers. I've got it down to if you're doing a 5-minute segment, I can cook a burger in 3.5 minutes.
Yeah, because that's recently as far as content, the video content that I'm now doing for the podcast, I did like a little cooking. There's this cookbook I have that's called Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers. So it has recipes from different movies.
Nice.
And so I just did like an eggs in a nest with red pepper sauce from Moonstruck, and I'm filming it. It's my iPhone on a tripod, and I'm talking on camera, and then trying to cook. And I just didn't have the means to keep cooking the dish, and so like it got a little burnt. But I was like, then I get to do a redemption video. So
there you go.
But it's definitely something I want to get better at and keep doing, but. What's your favorite? You go to the movies. What's your favorite snack?
Goobers.
Goobers.
Yeah.
Nice.
Goobers and snow caps, depending. If they don't have goobers, I go for snow caps. I always have snow caps.
Yeah.
I'm actually not a big fan of popcorn in a movie theater.
No?
Someone else has it, I'll have a few, but you get those little pieces of shit stuck in your teeth all the time, and it makes me crazy. Yeah.
And last question, what's the greatest lesson you've learned in food? It's a pretty light-handed question,
Wow. What are the greatest lesson I've learned? Okay, actually, I do. Okay. I've got a few of them, but probably the greatest lesson I've learned in food is obviously, the KISS method. Keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
That obviously some of the best stuff you can do is simple. But more important than that is that if you do have great ingredients and you have less of them than you think you need, you can definitely create magic in the kitchen, unquestionably. Nice. You hear my stomach growling? As I was saying that, my stomach went, I think I need a gyro.
What do you think of the Impossible Burger? What's your stance?
Well, they're friends of mine.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why they're friends of mine, because I think they're getting it right. And I say that very broadly. It doesn't taste like a burger. I describe the Impossible Burger, and I've told them this too, and I've talked about this in the New York Times, that it is the greatest imposter. They've actually done a really good job at creating something that is very similar. I've actually made a smashed onion burger with it.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it worked, but it just didn't taste, the meat doesn't taste like meat.
Yeah.
And vegetarians say, oh, it tastes like meat, but the problem with that is that the Impossible Burger is not, they're not gunning for the 4% of Americans that eat so strictly vegetarian.
Yeah.
They're gunning for the other 96% that eat meat. So I told them, you're getting there. And they had a new version, which is even better. Yeah. I tasted it at a French restaurant the other day, and it was actually really good. It was definitely a step in the right direction. So as far as, you know, making a patty that actually, you know, can taste like meat, they're not there yet. But they are working very hard to get there. I think they're also trying to diversify and do other types of foods as well. They didn't mean to focus on the hamburger. That was supposed to be their gateway.
Yeah.
Gateway food. But they are focusing on getting it right more. And they will. They're going to get there. They're going to get there.
Do you think it should be called a burger?
No. Because I think, for me, a burger really should only be made from beef. That's it. You know, there's turkey burgers are not, there shouldn't be burgers.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Turkey burgers, the reason that a beef burger is so perfect because it doesn't require anything but the cuts of beef and some salt and you're done.
Yeah.
So you can have that. The beef grease itself is a condiment, as far as I'm concerned. And you don't need anything more than a bun, which is a vehicle to get it into your mouth.
Yeah.
And it should taste like beef. That's it. That's a burger. Yeah, and the original American burger was beef. It wasn't anything else. It wasn't pork. It wasn't anything else. It was beef. And because it's so easy to cook.
Yeah.
Pork burgers are tough. They're really hard to make, get right. You cook them through, they can dry out. Turkey burgers is the same thing. Chicken burgers, shrimp burgers. They should be called, you know, the way a crab cake is a cake. Yeah. It should be called a turkey cake.
Turkey cake.
Shrimp cake. Tuna cake. Tuna burgers. Or tuna hot tuna sandwich. There's got to be some other name for it. But
yeah.
The problem is that people see the slender shape of the thing and it goes in their mouth the same way as a burger. They call it a burger. So. I can't prevent him from doing that.
But you're the burger expert, and you just need to declare, you know, like martial law or something.
That's right. I don't want to be that guy. I'm pretty humble.
George, I can't thank you enough for having me over and doing this episode. Please right now tell all the foodie fans where they can, you know, find you and obviously your books and all that.
Number one step is georgemotes.com, myname.com. That's a portal to all my stuff. It goes to my hamburger website, the Food Film Fest, photography, writing, all that kind of stuff. That's the best. But also on Instagram, Motzburger, Motzburger. Opening a restaurant in the same name soon, hopefully. We're
awesome.
Working on that. It's the next move. But we'll see. I mean,
yeah.
One step at a time. Motzburger on Twitter, Motzburger on Instagram, and also there's also hamburgeramerica.com.
Yeah.
But yeah, and the books are out there. The books are everywhere. The books are on Amazon.
Yeah. So heading from Brooklyn to Jersey, I want a burger. Where am I stopping?
Right around the corner. Right. A place called Hard Time Sundays.
Hard Time Sundays?
Arguably the best fast burger in New York City.
Awesome.
It's fantastic. It really is. It's a small four-stool counter. Yeah. One of my favorites. It's a great burger. You really should go. It's Cortelia Road, right around the corner.
I'm going to.
You should, definitely.
We have a little sign-off line. There's more to cut, so if you could just remind the foodie fans that there's more to cut.
There's more to cut.
Thank you.
Yummy, yummy, yummy. I got love in my tummy, and I feel like I'm loving you. Love you, such a sweet thing.